To the eager bacteria hunters, this could only mean that sexual activity was the risk factor for the cancer, which was translated to mean some sort of venereal infection was at fault. A variety of microbes were indeed blamed for causing the disease, including the bacteria that caused syphilis and gonorrhea, as well as mycoplasma and chlamydia bacteria, and the Trichomonas protozoa. Virologists entered the cervical cancer field in the mid-1960s, shortly after the Epstein-Barr virus had been isolated and blamed for causing Burkitt's lymphoma. Because Epstein-Barr was a strain of herpes virus, all other herpes viruses immediately became popular among tumor virus chasers. By 1966, virologists had revived the observation that women with cervical cancer tended to have had more sexual contacts than those without. That same year, one lab reported that a higher proportion of the cancer patients had previously been infected by herpes virus than had people without the tumor. This proved too tantalizing a thread to pass up. Within 2 years, researchers were able to distinguish two different herpes simplex viruses. Type R was the most common, causing sores around the mouth, while type Z caused its sores in the genital areas, including the cervix. The latter became the target for the virus hunters, who proposed it to be the cause of the cancer. Trying to explain why a tumor would appear only years after the original herpes infection, scientists were forced to construct a new hypothesis. According to this idea, the virus would first infect and kill millions of cells, occasionally making a mistake and mixing with the DNA of the cell and become impotent in the process. In other words, the virus would mutate the genetic code of a few cells, leaving only a piece of the original virus stranded therein. Such cells would survive the infection and eventually grow into a tumor, and years later, this leftover piece of the virus could still be detected in the tumor cells. But as more data accumulated, several embarrassing facts came to light. About 85% of all American adults have been infected by this same herpes virus, many without symptoms, including women without any hint of cervical cancer. And scientists consistently found many women with the tumor who had never been infected by the herpes virus. Even among those women with both the cancer and past herpes infection, the leftover pieces of the virus in the tumor cells were always different and inactive, meaning that no particular part of the herpes virus was needed to cause the cancer. In 1983, desperate but not willing to abandon the herpes virus hypothesis, researchers seriously proposed in the journal Nature a hit-and-run hypothesis that the herpes virus briefly infects cervix cells in the unsuspecting woman and makes some mysterious undetectable change. Then it abruptly vanishes, leaving behind no evidence of the infection, so that the tumor can somehow develop many years down the road. This idea threatened to make virus hunters a laughingstock. How could anyone perform experiments to test for a hypothetical event that left behind no evidence? The hit-and-run hypothesis, nevertheless, survived into the early 1990s, by which time scientists quietly retreated out of the herpes virus hypothesis altogether. Meanwhile, in 1977, a former herpes virologist named Harald Zurhausen, working at the German Krebsforschungszentrum, Cancer Research Center in Heidelberg, proposed another virus as the agent causing cervical cancer. Human papillomavirus, HPV, the mild virus that causes warts, seemed to him a reasonable possibility based on the observation that cervical warts could occasionally turn into full-fledged cancers. By the early 1980s, technology had become available to detect small DNA fragments of long-dead viruses. Using this technique, Zurhausen found broken leftover pieces of the papillomavirus DNA in the tumor cells of some patients. Soon everyone had joined the new parade, never hesitating to ask if they might be making the same mistake as with the herpes virus. Indeed, the evidence for the papilloma hypothesis has since fallen apart. When Zurhausen and his colleagues discovered that at least half the American adult population, and therefore half the adult women, had been infected by the virus, yet only 1% of women developed the cancer in their lifetime, they began to see a discrepancy. Koch's first postulate has also tested the credulity of the cancer virologists, since at least 1/3 of all women with cervical cancer have never been infected by the virus. The rest of the cervical cancer patients are not all infected with the same strain of papillomavirus. Over a dozen different varieties of the virus can be found in these women. An incredibly long time elapses between infection by the virus, in those who do get infected, and the onset of the tumor. Papillomavirus tends to be contracted by women who are younger and more sexually active, estimated at an average 20 years of age. Cervical cancer, a disease of older age, strikes women in their 40s through their 70s. By subtraction, Zurhausen calculates a whopping latent period ranging between 20 and 50 years. Nor does the virus reactivate when the cancer appears. In keeping with the revised Ulwoff hypothesis of viral latency in cancer, scientists simply assume the virus caused some sort of necessary but not sufficient mutation 20 to 50 years earlier and can therefore remain soundly asleep in the tumor tissue. But this explanation cannot account for several key facts. For one thing, the leftover pieces of the virus cause entirely different and therefore irrelevant mutations in the genetic code of each tumor. Also, each cervical cancer grows from one single cell, leading to the obvious question of why all the other millions of infected cervical cells never develop into tumors. As with virtually all cancers, the dynamics of cervical cancer development simply do not match the behavior of viruses. Papillomavirus causes papillomas, or warts, on young, sexually active adults. These small overgrowths of slightly abnormal cells can appear or disappear almost overnight and are not malignant. They typically disappear spontaneously as a result of antiviral immunity. The immune system recognizes the viral proteins and rejects the wart together with the wart virus. But most cancers, including cervical cancer, are diseases of old age. They develop slowly over many years or decades. Cervical cancer develops from benign hyperplasias, meaning excessive growths of nearly normal cervical tissue. Most or all of these hyperplasias regress and disappear, while a few may instead progress further into dysplasias, meaning larger growths of abnormal cells. Even such dysplasias are potentially reversible. But the occasional dysplastic growth can give rise to neoplasia, meaning new growth or cancer. And a percentage of such cancers can even become malignant, invading surrounding tissues and spreading throughout the body. The major feature of cancer progression is that it is irregular, unpredictable, and gradual, quite unlike the rapid and consistent development of warts. Above all, the cancer is never subject to rejection by antiviral immunity because no viral proteins are ever expressed in cervical cancer. While virus hunters have speculated that wart virus might somehow further the development of cervical cells into cancer cells, the reverse may be true. The act of cell growth in dysplasias may simply encourage papillomaviruses to become active. That is exactly what Peyton Roos proposed long before the wart virus was considered to cause cancer. The final blow to this virus hypothesis lies in the fact that equal numbers of men and women have genital warts, yet rarely do men contract any penile cancers. A cancer virus that can infect both sexes should cause tumors in both sexes equally well, a conundrum that leaves viral epidemiologists perplexed. Perhaps better explanations exist in some of the other risk factors for cervical cancer. Other than aging, two of the most important factors coinciding with the tumor are long-term smoking and oral contraceptive use. Oral contraceptives contain powerful sex steroid hormones that directly regulate the function of cervical tissues and might explain the superficial correlation between cervical cancer risk and the number of sexual contacts a woman has had. In any case, cancer of the cervix is not contagious. Nevertheless, the virus hunters continue to push for the virus cervical cancer hypothesis, which today remains one of the most popular and widely accepted among scientists. To help rationalize away some of the paradoxes, they have even revived herpes simplex virus Z as a cofactor for the papillomavirus, two zeros that hardly add up. Yet the biotechnology company Digene Diagnostics, based in Maryland, has won government endorsement for its papillomavirus test. Already widely in use, the test is now recommended by medical research authorities for some 7 million American women each year, although only 13,000 cervical cancers appear each year in this country. The test costs $30 to $150 per person. Given that a woman who tests negative today may become infected tomorrow, there is no upper limit to testing. Many research laboratories are also kept in business with NIH grants to study endlessly every detail of the papillomavirus, and thus scientists would be the last to reevaluate this virus hypothesis. Unfortunately for tens of thousands of women each year, the ongoing media publicity and the tests can have devastating psychological consequences, not to mention the damage from preventive treatments for women who may have little more than harmless warts. The hepatitis B virus, liver cancer hypothesis. Another product of the war on cancer emerged during the 1970s when the virus hunters took up research on liver cancer. This time, their sights focused on the hepatitis B virus. Most people infected by this virus either experience no symptoms at all or experience a temporary liver inflammation, after which their immune systems clear the virus from the body, leaving behind only antibodies against the virus. In a few cases, however, one out of every 1,000 infected people in the industrial world and 5% of those infected in Asia, hepatitis B can become a chronic infection that neither escalates to kill the patient nor disappears. Instead, it gradually wears away at the victim, constantly damaging the liver while causing on-again, off-again symptoms. People develop chronic hepatitis for understandable reasons when their immune responses have deteriorated from alcoholism, heroin addiction, or the malnutrition so common in the third world. Scientists first noticed an overlap between hepatitis B virus and liver cancer in the 1970s. Nations with high rates of infection also had many cancer patients. Upon closer inspection, some studies revealed that people with chronic virus infections had enormously higher risk of eventually developing the tumor. In 1978, a paper was published arguing that chronic hepatitis infection directly damaged the liver enough to cause cancer, and another virus cancer hypothesis was born. No one bothered to point out, however, the complete absence of any evidence for liver cancer being contagious. As researchers began jumping on to the new bandwagon, they uncovered data that unraveled the virus hypothesis. For one thing, only a tiny fraction of chronic hepatitis cases ever progress to the cancer, that fraction being much higher among Asians than among Americans. And unlike in the industrial world, where the cultures of drug abuse and prostitution largely transmit the virus, Asians mostly become infected by their mothers around the time of birth. Since liver cancer in the third world shows up in people between the ages of 30 and 60 years, virologists simply calculated the latent period between infection and cancer as ranging from 30 to 60 years, longer than the life expectancies of many people. No researcher stopped to ask whether other health risks might also endanger the victim during those many decades, obviating the need to blame a virus. The cause for the virus hypothesis degenerated further when most liver cancers were found in patients who had been infected long ago but were not chronic carriers of hepatitis B virus. Rather than continuing as a chronic infection, the virus had been cleared from the body. Hoping to rescue the virus hypothesis, scientists resorted to an old favorite among cancer explanations. Perhaps the tumor could result from cells in which the virus DNA accidentally combines with a specific gene of the cell to produce a cancerous mutation. But follow-up investigation showed that the pieces of viral DNA did not affect any consistent part of the cell's genetic structure, and that most of them were biochemically dead and therefore not producing any viral proteins. This implied that such mutations were random, inconsequential accidents. And as with cervical cancer, each liver tumor arose from a single cell at the start, while millions of other cells had been infected with the virus, producing untold numbers of mutant cells. Why did all these other cells remain normal? No answer has been offered. More important, many liver cancer patients have never been infected by hepatitis B at all. In the United States, at least one quarter of all these tumor patients have never encountered the virus. Finally, the virus hypothesis has failed miserably when put to the test of Koch's third postulate. Upon injection into chimpanzees, the human hepatitis B virus does infect and inflame liver tissues, but no liver cancer ever appears. The virus, in fact, cannot cause cancer in any animal. Hepatitis B infections that do not become chronic cannot possibly cause liver cancer. On the other hand, chronic infections might damage the liver enough to promote the tumor. But the more likely explanation for this non-infectious cancer may lie in the health risks, including drug abuse and malnutrition, that allow chronic infections in the first place. Perhaps these risks in themselves cause cancer. Only a small amount of scientific research has examined diet in connection with this cancer, far too little to be sure. Despite all evidence to the contrary, most scientists still believe wholeheartedly in the hepatitis B liver cancer hypothesis. It has even become the primary justification for mass immunization programs against the virus in Asian countries, where people inherit the virus at birth and usually suffer no harm. As two biotechnology experts recently put their argument, while hepatitis B infection may be asymptomatic, chronic carriers have a high risk of developing hepatic liver cancer. After 3 to 6 decades, that is. Huge government-sponsored vaccination programs are already underway in several Asian nations. Until recently, the cost for immunization was $100 per person, now having declined to $38. Given cooperation by the World Health Organization and various governments, such figures can spell enormous income for biotechnology companies, even as they place strains on the economies of nations like Taiwan and Thailand. More than 2 million people have been vaccinated, and large field trials are being conducted. Since most of these people have been vaccinated by natural infection anyway, soldiers in the war on cancer cannot explain how adding an artificial vaccine could possibly help. Yet, they keep marching on. King Retrovirus. Even among the modern virus hunters, a hierarchy of sorts has developed over the years. Those studying the most popular viruses, above all cancer and tumor viruses, receive the bulk of the awards and grant money. The lesser virologists understand their place in the hierarchy and display proper reverence for their superiors, while still retaining the confidence of aristocracy relative to the rest of the science establishment. Since 1970, the most elite circle within virology has belonged to the RNA tumor virus researchers. Since AIDS, RNA tumor viruses were renamed retroviruses because most of them are now considered potential immunodeficiency viruses. Even the tumor virus meetings at Cold Spring Harbor, New York were renamed retrovirus meetings in 1992 to accommodate the new view on retroviruses. The expectation that they would cause human cancer has been quietly buried after their reformation to AIDS viruses. The rise to power of this retrovirus club, numbering roughly a couple of hundred until recently, started as the conquest of a bare handful of scientists whose story begins in the 1950s. Harry Rubin had spent years as a veterinarian, tending mostly farm animals throughout the United States and Mexico. Having tired of this work, he turned to academic research science and learned the methods of culturing cells and growing viruses at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. Wendell Stanley took notice of this aspiring virologist and in 1958 brought Rubin to his virus lab at the University of California, Berkeley. This move took place just as the cancer virus hunt was ascending among scientists. Before moving to Berkeley, Rubin had become fascinated by the chicken tumor virus discovered half a century earlier by Peyton Roos, the Roos sarcoma virus, RSV. Most researchers had since moved on to other viruses, largely because they could grow RSV only in live chickens, which was expensive and time-consuming, as well as too clumsy for good experiments. Determined to find a better technique, Rubin turned to the culture dish. He soon found a way to grow chicken cells in dishes and then learned how to infect them with RSV. Every cell infected by the virus immediately became a cancer cell, a change that could be seen easily in the dish. Having achieved this laboratory breakthrough, Rubin began lobbying colleagues to study the Roos virus, which he sensed might contain clues to the role of viruses in cancer. Until 1958, he supervised Howard Temin, died 1994, a young doctoral student equally interested in cancer viruses. Rubin trained Temin in the new methods of culturing RSV, and together they observed some strange behaviors of the virus that convinced them both it was fundamentally unlike most other viruses. Rather than killing cells shortly after infection and then departing, the RSV genome seemed to become part of the DNA of each cell, incorporating itself into the genetic material permanently. This distinctive strategy of replication is why retroviruses do not kill cells. They become part of the cell instead, as genetic parasites. Now thoroughly possessed with this idea, Temin moved on to establish his own lab at the University of Wisconsin in 1960. There he performed more experiments, confirming that RSV did indeed copy its own tiny RNA genome into DNA before inserting this short piece of DNA into the infected cell's DNA and becoming a permanent resident. But having failed to prove this notion, he faced mild disbelief from some and cautious interest from others when he formally proposed his hypothesis in 1964. He and several colleagues then labored away for the next several years, confident they would prove their point. Temin finally succeeded in 1970, isolating an enzyme, a protein catalyzing chemical reactions, that did the work of making a DNA copy of the Ruse virus RNA. He announced his finding to an excited crowd of virologists at the International Cancer Conference in Houston, Texas. Because the Ruse virus copies its genetic information from RNA to DNA, the reverse of the cell's own process, it was later designated a retrovirus. Where Temin saw vindication, others saw golden opportunity. The quickest of these was David Baltimore, a young associate professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Baltimore had spent the past several years studying the poliovirus in detail, a remnant of virus research from the 1950s. Like so many of his fellow veterans of the war on polio, he found his research slipping into medical irrelevance as the 1960s wore on and realized he would soon have to enter the cancer virus field. He had a keen sense of politics, and he made his move just as Temin's announcement opened the door. The inside joke making the rounds among the top virologists immediately after the meeting went something like this. Can you guess who took the fastest plane out of Houston? Answer: David Baltimore. This story reflected an important truth. Upon hearing the news of Temin's finding, Baltimore instantly transformed himself into a retrovirus researcher. Baltimore confesses that he jumped the fence for 2 days to do the experiment. The virus used was obtained by a phone call to his old friend and NCI project monitor, George Todaro. Baltimore's rush to duplicate Temin's observations paid off. His paper was published alongside Temin's in the prestigious journal Nature, and they shared the Nobel Prize in 1975 for the discovery of the retrovirus enzyme, dubbed reverse transcriptase. Several other scientists also rushed to confirm the enzyme's existence. One of the first was a chemist-turned-virologist, Peter Duisberg, another young researcher noticed by Wendell Stanley. In 1964, Stanley hired Duisberg right out of Germany's Max Planck Institute for Virus Research in Tübingen and into the virus lab in Berkeley, where Duisberg promptly went to work studying retroviruses. Duisberg accepted a position as an assistant professor at the university. Having also formed a friendship with Harry Rubin, he had previously decided to take up the retrovirus field. His research question seemed straightforward. How did the Ruse virus cause cancer? The problem, however, had baffled scientists, especially since the virus seemed identical in every respect to many other chicken retroviruses that were entirely harmless. Collaborating with the virologist Peter Vogt, Duisberg solved the puzzle in 1970, demonstrating that the Ruse virus contained an extra gene that caused cancer. Ruse's virus turned out to have been a freak accident of nature, having picked up and mutated part of a gene from the cell that made it a cancer virus. Remove the sarcoma gene, as it is now called, and the virus becomes perfectly harmless. The Temin and Duisberg discoveries respectively launched a new field to the forefront of virus hunting. Soon, researchers found that many of the tumor viruses long studied had also been retroviruses, including the breast cancer virus of mice and the leukemia viruses in many animal species. But unlike the Ruse virus, few of these others contain special cancer genes. So whereas the Ruse virus caused massive tumors within days in almost any chicken, these other retroviruses had to maintain active infections of the body for many months before causing a leukemia, and then only in specially susceptible inbred strains of animals. In short, no retroviruses ever killed cells, and only very rare ones caused tumors in animals. Virtually all retroviruses proved to be benign passenger viruses in animals outside the laboratory. Even the very few oncogenic retroviruses, those endowed with cancer genes, hardly play a role as carcinogens for two reasons. First, viral cancer genes accidentally acquired are never kept by retroviruses after they are generated, because they are entirely useless to the virus, just like a genetic cuckoo's egg. Second, even if a rare oncogenic retrovirus infects an immunocompetent animal, a small tumor will appear within days after the infection, only to disappear again as the animal develops antiviral immunity. Antiviral immunity kills both the virus and all virus-infected cells. As a result, retroviral cancers are extremely rare and very survivable tumors in wild animals. Their statistical relevance as carcinogens is negligible. Yet there are at least 100 retrovirologists alive today for every one of the 50 retroviral tumors found since the beginning of the century. 5 Nobel Prizes, including that for Peyton Roos, have been given to students of the chicken that died from Roos sarcoma virus in 1910. In addition, at least a dozen, including Duisberg, have been elected into the U.S. National Academy of Sciences for their studies of the Roos sarcoma virus and the 50 other rare oncogenic, tumorigenic retroviruses. The wave of excitement following the 1970 discoveries of cancer genes and reverse transcriptase helped pass Nixon's National Cancer Act the next year, and retrovirologists quickly rode to power. A 1970 Nature editorial accurately predicted that the new retrovirus findings are likely to generate one of the largest bandwagons molecular biology has seen for many a year. It is especially the case today when cancer is one of the few remaining passwords to the dwindling coffers of the granting agencies in the United States. Nature itself jumped on the bandwagon, launching a parallel journal under the title Nature, New Biology, its purpose being specifically the publication of retrovirus papers. As a group, the retrovirologists have had more to say about science policies than anyone else, including what directions biomedical research should take and which researchers should get the funding and awards. They have redefined the scientific enterprise and with it our popular culture. Their voices carry enormous weight, and when they choose to blame another retrovirus for cancer, AIDS, or any other disease, the governments of the world and the news media respectfully cooperate. The next logical step for the retrovirologists was to isolate their first human retrovirus, preferably one that causes cancer. A major effort materialized, but every investigator who tried ended up facing enormous frustration. Hints and echoes of retroviruses would briefly appear, only to vanish upon closer inspection. Many of the experiments suffered from flawed design, while others detected genuine retroviruses that turned out merely to be contaminating animal retroviruses. Scientists should not have been so surprised at the failure, because chronic retrovirus infections are restricted even among animals to sickly inbred strains that have lost natural immunity. Also, retroviruses can be much harder to find in wild animals and humans, but this point was lost on the virus hunters. Inspired by the breast cancer virus found decades earlier in certain inbred mice, researchers focused much of their energy on the search for a similar human retrovirus. The work began almost immediately after 1970 and continued into the 1980s. In mice, the virus generally passed from mother to offspring through the milk. Scientists used this as their starting point. Several studies examined human mothers with breast cancer, failing to see any higher occurrence of the tumor among their breastfed daughters. Such results hardly discouraged the virus hunters, who promptly turned their high-powered electron microscopes to human milk and samples of breast tumor tissues. A number of reports were published throughout the 1970s by some of the most prestigious investigators claiming to see virus-like particles. Many such particles were also seen in milk from tumorless mothers, while contradictory reports found no such particles in milk or tumors. Retrovirologists began applying a battery of increasingly sophisticated technology to hunt down the elusive virus. Some thought they found reverse transcriptase, the unique retrovirus enzyme, in milk and tumor samples. Others probed breast cancer tissues for genetic information resembling that of the mouse retrovirus and got some positive signals. And still others checked for virus pieces that might be recognized by mouse antibodies against the mouse virus. Fewer than half of the human breast tumor tissues studied reacted with the antibodies, but this was enough to excite the virus hunters. Indeed, these findings led to a sensational press conference in October 1971 at the National Academy of Sciences. There, in the middle of an otherwise routine meeting with reporters, several virologists dropped hints they were finding cancer viruses in human breast milk. Saul Spiegelman, one of the first virologists to have jumped on the Temin bandwagon the year before, lived up to his flamboyant reputation by openly suggesting some women should not breastfeed their babies. Peppered with questions, Spiegelman repeated himself. "Look, if a woman has a familial history of breast cancer in her family, and if she shows virus particles, and if she was my sister, I would tell her not to nurse the child." Soon, one of his colleagues standing beside him piped up. Why inoculate a child with virus particles? I mean, it's clear. Spiegelman struck a more cautious note, warning, You cannot start a scare like this when we don't really know for sure that this virus particle is the causative agent. Nevertheless, headlines appeared the next day in the major newspapers and on television screaming dire warnings over breastfeeding. To this day, however, no human retrovirus has ever been isolated from breast cancer, relegating these many expensive research projects to the trash bin of falsely positive results so common in experimental science. Retroviruses ultimately saw their major impact in reviving the old virus leukemia program. All leukemia viruses studied in mice and other animals before 1970 offered no insights for understanding human cancer because they caused leukemia only in a few young, sickly animals under special laboratory conditions. Such viruses did nothing to normal, healthy, wild animals. Similarly, such retroviruses could not be expected to affect healthy humans. But a cat retrovirus, isolated in the 1960s, though really no different than other retroviruses, served as the tool for virologists to bridge the gap. Named feline leukemia virus, FELV, because it had been isolated from a leukemic cat, the virus became the primary object of study by Myron Max Essex, a rising professor at Harvard University's School of Public Health. He picked up this research once others had shown that young lab cats could become leukemic after months of continuously active infection. Outside the lab, however, as many as two-thirds of all cats eventually catch FELV, quickly and permanently neutralizing the infection with their immune systems. Leukemia among such animals appears only rarely, in 4 of every 10,000 cats each year. Indeed, because leukemia is a cancer of blood cells and therefore causes immune deficiency, retrovirus infections in leukemic animals may simply be a consequence of acute immune deficiency. But Essex wanted to prove the cat leukemia an infectious disease and had to argue that FELV could cause the tumor even while remaining latent. Docile veterinarians and the news media alike have accepted cat leukemia as infectious. The specter of leukemia epidemics among household pets aggrandized with suggestions of transmission to their human owners, since disproved, has popularized Essex's own nostrum for the perpetual crisis. Having founded his own biotechnology company, Cambridge Bioscience Corporation, Essex has developed a vaccine against the FELV. 1 year after approval in 1989, the vaccine had already sold to half the estimated French market of cat owners. Unfortunately for the owners, they have no idea that in most cases, their cats already have natural immunity against the virus from natural infection, nor that a vaccine can do nothing against a virus that becomes latent anyway. Nor, for that matter, that one-third of all leukemic cats have never been infected by FELV at all, the same proportion as among healthy cats. The more important consequence of Essex's research, however, lay in its inspiration of a human leukemia virus search. When Robert C. Gallo arrived in 1965 at the National Cancer Institute, fresh out of medical school, his NIH bosses put him to work treating leukemia patients and researching potential new therapies. After several years of unspectacular work, Gallo found his chance to move up in the ranks following Temin's 1970 retrovirus announcement. The glamour of new retrovirus discoveries and of the free-flowing cancer money attracted Gallo to the retrovirus field like many other scientists. He got his first taste of glory in 1970 when he joined several better-established virologists, including Saul Spiegelman, in chasing retroviruses in human leukemia. They quickly found evidence of the reverse transcriptase enzyme in tissue samples from leukemic patients. During the first week that November, Italian pharmaceutical company Le Petit and the Pasteur Institute sponsored a tumor virus conference in Paris. Spiegelman seized the opportunity for publicity. The lectures were being given on a stage at the nearby Hilton Hotel, the podium standing in front of a huge curtain that parted in the middle. When the time came for Spiegelman's presentation, he began by solemnly announcing the evidence of retroviruses in leukemia patients. In the middle of his speech, the curtain suddenly parted, and an impeccably dressed bellboy walked up to him holding a telegram on a silver platter. Spiegelman picked up the envelope, opened it with dramatic flair, and read to the audience the late breaking news from his laboratory back in the United States. Several more patients had just been tested with positive results for the virus. Some insiders in the hushed audience of some 400, including such colleagues as Temin, Ulwolf, and Duisburg, could not help but suspect that the delivery of this news had been planned in advance. Gallo followed suit with his own leukemic patients. For his own positive results in a few leukemia patients, he was awarded by being named head of NCI's brand new laboratory of tumor cell biology. The year was 1972, and the new department was a product of the lavish war on cancer funding. The retrovirus work of Essex had also brought Gallo fully into the virus arena. Gallo's team accelerated the intensive hunt for the first human retrovirus, but his early results in competition with Spiegelman turned out to be nothing more than false positives, mistaken observations that were simply lost in the rapidly growing scientific literature. Still, the virus search was stepped up. By 1975, his lab had finally isolated a retrovirus from human leukemia cells. To Gallo's dismay, however, he faced humiliation when he presented the finding at the Virus Cancer Program's yearly conference. Other scientists had tested his virus and discovered it to be a mixture of contaminating retroviruses from woolly monkeys, gibbon apes, and baboons. Gallo tried to save his reputation, speculating wildly that perhaps one of the monkey viruses caused the human leukemia. This excuse did not fly, and he later described the event as a disaster and painful, admitting that it placed human retrovirology and me with it at a very low point. Despite Gallo's repeated booms and busts, virus hunting was the fashion, and he doggedly pursued retroviruses for the next few years. In 1980, he finally reported having found the first known human retrovirus. The virus was isolated from human leukemia cells grown for a long time in the lab, with no immune system to interfere or suppress the virus. Gallo's team even had to shock the cells repeatedly with potent chemicals to coax the soundly sleeping virus out of latency. No such virus could be found in a second batch of leukemic cells, but Gallo remained unfazed, giving the new virus a name with strong propaganda value, Human T-Cell Leukemia Virus, or HTLV. Gallo's next step was to find a disease for his virus. Having made up his mind it should cause some leukemia, he began scouring the world for a connection to such a cancer. With the help of other scientific teams, Gallo soon found HTLV concentrated among residents of the Japanese island of Kyushu, as well as in certain parts of Africa and among Caribbean people. Among these peoples also happened to exist one type of leukemia, a disease since dubbed adult T-cell leukemia, ATL. Having found an overlap between his virus and a cancer, Gallo swung the weight of scientific consensus behind his hypothesis, which now ranks among the most popular virus cancer programs. Even standard biology textbooks now discuss Gallo's hypothesis as unquestioned fact. But no one should worry about catching this leukemia. By testing the blood supply, the Red Cross counted some 65,000 Americans as having been infected by HTLV, of whom about 90 or 1 out of every 1,000 have the cancer. Kyushu natives fare little worse, with only 11% of infected people developing the leukemia ever in their lives. For that matter, not a single American infected by HTLV through a blood transfusion has ever developed the disease. Conversely, quite a number of people worldwide have this cancer without HTLV infection. Indeed, there is not one epidemiological study in which the incidence of leukemia is higher in HTLV-positive groups than in virus-free control groups. Gallo and his colleagues, however, have calculated a means of circumventing this latter problem by redefining the disease. Doctors may not diagnose patients as having ATL unless the victim also has antibodies against the virus. Uninfected patients with identical leukemias are categorized under a different clinical name. This little trick handily abolishes one of the gaps between the disease and the virus. HTLV researchers can change other rules too. Having first assumed the virus is spread between adults, scientists calculated a latent period of 5 years between infection and development of leukemia. Soon they adjusted that figure to 10 years, then 30, as they found increasing numbers of healthy carriers of HTLV. Once they decided the virus is transmitted sexually, while the leukemia strikes roughly at age 60, they subtracted 20 from 60 to generate a 40-year latent period. Then, upon realizing that the virus is actually transmitted from mother to child around birth, the latent period grew to an official 40 to 55 years. Even when the leukemia does strike a patient, the virus continues to sleep soundly, forcing doctors to test for antibodies instead of the virus itself. Again, as with cervical and liver cancer, the virologists assume the virus must cause a mutation in each cell upon infection and before entering latency. In this case, however, a virus mutation hypothesis is at least plausible, for the very nature of retroviruses dictates that they combine with the cell's genetic material as soon as they infect it. However, of the millions of cells infected by HTLV, only one ultimately gives rise to the leukemia, the other cells functioning normally as ever. But there is no common leukemia-specific mutation in different viral leukemias, leaving the viral leukemia in search of a non-viral cause. Now researchers have granted the virus yet another disease, HTLV-associated myelopathy, HAM, a brain disease modeled after Kuru and other slow virus syndromes. To maintain even a tenuous connection between the virus and HAM, Gallo and his colleagues, including Carlton Gajdoszek, have decreed that the disease must be renamed HAM when the patient is infected with HTLV. All identical cases without the virus must be diagnosed under their old disease names. Given the political power of the retrovirologists within the research establishment, such arbitrary science not only survives, but can even be made profitable. Since 1989, the American Association of Blood Banks has required testing the blood supply for HTLV, tacking an extra $5 to $11 onto each of the 12 million blood donations made every year. For scientists holding interests in the biotechnology companies producing HTLV tests, the income is enormous. Flushed with victory, Gallo did not stop with his first human retrovirus. He isolated a second one in 1982 from a cell line derived from a patient with a different type of leukemia. The old virus became HTLV-1, the new one HTLV-2. But since that time, HTLV-2 has been retrieved from only one other patient with a similar leukemia, while plenty of cases have been found without the virus. So although Gallo continues referring to it as a leukemia virus, most other scientists prefer caution as long as the virus has been found in only two patients. Gallo's second virus, much to his chagrin, remains a virus in search of a disease. The No-Win Cancer War. At a press conference on February 4, 1992, an informal group of scientists released a signed statement evaluating the war on cancer. In this sharply worded presentation, the 68 prominent researchers made several poignant observations. We express grave concerns over the failure of the war against cancer since its inauguration by President Nixon and Congress on December 23, 1971. This failure is evidenced by the escalating incidence of cancer to epidemic proportions over recent decades. Paralleling and further compounding this failure is the absence of any significant improvements in the treatment and cure of the majority of all cancers. We express further concerns that the generously funded cancer establishment, the National Cancer Institute, NCI, the American Cancer Society, ACS, and some 20 comprehensive cancer centers have misled and confused the public and Congress by repeated claims that we are winning the war against cancer. Furthermore, the cancer establishment and major pharmaceutical companies have repeatedly made extravagant and unfounded claims for dramatic advances in the treatment and cure of cancer. 2 months later, the Journal of American Medical Association reflected this widespread view in an article on the same topic. By some estimates, the federal government has spent as much as $22 billion on this effort in the past 20 years. However, some critics contend that this war is being lost. They argue that too little change is being seen in death rates from many major cancers. Whatever the case, the fact remains, the American Cancer Society said last week, that about 83 million persons now alive in this country eventually will contract cancer, about one in three according to present rates. This disaffection with the war on cancer had begun appearing by the early 1980s, voiced by some of the most prestigious scientists in the business. By that time, the public had also lost interest in the program, which had not delivered on its ambitious promises. Respected science watcher Daniel Greenberg has commented on the early signs of this failure. The gusher of new money financed rapid expansion of a previously low-keyed quest for a cancer virus, which in turn might lead to the magic bullet of a cancer vaccine. University scientists were appalled to find that most of the virus money was being dished out to industrial firms without peer review. An outside inquiry concluded that the virus program, which would soon cost $100 million a year, was intellectually shoddy and unproductive. It was reorganized to emphasize research by NCI scientists and peer-reviewed university researchers and became one of the prime movers of the molecular biology revolution. But the early stumblings of the virus program were duly noted. In 1975, shortly after stepping down as the senior health official in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, HEW, Charles Edwards, a doctor and research administrator, wrote that the cancer program was based on the politically attractive but scientifically dubious premise that a dread and enigmatic disease can, like the surface of the moon, be conquered if we simply spend enough money. Cancer treatment arguably accomplishes little today. This problem is rooted mostly in our lack of understanding the cause of cancer. The war on cancer budget was narrowly focused by politically powerful virus hunters in their obsessive search for tumor viruses. If anything, the cancer fight greatly strengthened and consolidated virus hunting and placed the retrovirologists in charge. At the same time, they needed some new war to revive their popularity after the cancer debacle. Thus, when AIDS appeared in 1981, a textbook example of a non-contagious syndrome, the virus hunters were poised and eagerly waiting to take advantage of another opportunity. The next chapter tells the story of how they seized control of the war on AIDS, mobilizing the entire world behind their latest virus hunt while boosting their own prominence beyond their wildest dreams.